Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection. Take a look at any photo of children from the 1950s, and you can't help but notice how few are overweight. Today, one in every three of children between the ages of 2 and 19 are overweight or obese. Welcome to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're going to discuss obesity in children and adolescents. At Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments about the program today, you can reach us at 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our usual email address is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. My guest today is pediatric endocrinologist Dr. Henry Anholt. He's widely published both in the lay and professional literature and has an avid practice in endocrinology still back in Hackensack, New Jersey. And he is representing the Endocrine Society today in our request for some national expert on obesity. Dr. Anholt, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you so much, Thad. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into this this problem, let's just do some definitions. Tell us a little bit about endocrinology. What do endocrinologists do, and how are they involved in obesity in particular?
So endocrinology is the study of chemical messengers or hormones. And chemical messengers made in one part of the body, typically called glands, travel through the bloodstream and affect a distant part in the body. So it's the study of hormones, both normal and abnormal. That's what an endocrinologist does. Now, its impact or the interest of endocrinologists in obesity is that the rise of obesity is causing an increase in type 2 diabetes. And the way that that happens is as a child becomes heavier, their body begins to make more insulin. And after a while, in the simplest terms, the pancreas, which makes insulin, tires out and is unable to keep up with the demand. When that happens, that's when diabetes presents itself. So for us as pediatric endocrinologists, identifying those children who are at risk for developing type 2 diabetes and intervening before they develop diabetes is one of the reasons that we are so concerned and so involved in the care of these children.
And the reason insulin is increased in obesity is not only just that there's increased food that the insulin is, or glucose in particular, that insulin is trying to get into the different cells of the body, but isn't there some resistance as you develop obesity to the effects of insulin as well?
Well, that's exactly right, Tad. What happens is as you begin to gain more and more fat cells, the body has difficulty making enough insulin to do its job. Insulin's main job is to take calories and sugar in the bloodstream and push it into the cell. And as we get more and more fat cells, it's much harder to push that sugar and calories into the cells. And the cells themselves aren't that friendly to insulin. So what happens is, as the body is trying to push those calories into the cell, it finds it harder and harder to do so because the cells are less welcoming to the effects of insulin. Insulin levels begin to rise, affecting other parts of the body, including increasing the risk for high blood pressure, abnormal cholesterol, liver disease, and ultimately the pancreas can't keep up with the production of insulin. And again, that's when type 2 diabetes presents itself.
Okay. And while we're on diabetes, before we get to obesity, let's just once again differentiate the type 2 diabetes, where you're talking about this insulin resistance and the wearing out of those cells in the pancreas that make insulin, versus type 1 diabetes that we often hear referred to as well.
So type 2 diabetes is when the body, as we said before, cannot keep up with the need for the insulin that needs to be made. So the body, after a while, the pancreas tires out. The body can make insulin and can make a lot of insulin in those cases, but simply the insulin isn't as effective as it would be. On the other hand, in type 1 diabetes, which has been called by a bunch of different names, including juvenile diabetes, because it typically affects children, but can affect young adults and middle-aged adults and even older adults, is also known as autoimmune diabetes. And that's when the body recognizes the pancreas insulin-producing cells as being foreign, begins to attack them, and destroys the body's ability to produce insulin. That kind of diabetes is called type 1 or juvenile diabetes. The difference in treatment is very important because individuals with type 1 diabetes can only be treated with insulin. Oral medications and diet do not help. Although it's always important to keep a healthy diet, they can't treat diabetes per se. And that's an important fact because a lot of people have a misconception that type 1 diabetes is also the same condition as type 2 diabetes that can be treated with diet and exercise initially, but type 1 diabetes cannot. So I'll oftentimes hear from friends or parents, and they say, well, why can't my child just diet and eat the right things, and then their diabetes will be treated? It's because they can't make insulin, and our bodies need insulin to process the calories that we eat. Not so in type 2 diabetes, again, because the exercise, lifestyle, positive lifestyle change, increasing in exercise, and watching what you eat is typically the first step in addressing type 2 diabetes. And if that fails, there are lots of oral medications that are useful. Some patients ultimately may require insulin, but there's some time to get there.
All right, so obesity. What is obesity? How is it defined? And we've talked on the program a number of times that it's very important to have very succinct definitions so we know when we're doing science that we're comparing apples and apples. So what are we using today? How do we define obesity and overweight, and how can we know we're comparing the same thing generations apart?
Well, Ted, it's important to note that in children, it's a moving target. So, for example, where a 70-pound 4-year-old child would be definitely considered overweight, a 10- or 11-year-old child would not. So, as you said, it's important to compare apples to apples, and one of the ways of doing that is coming up with a standard measure of overweight that could be applied across the age group. Now, in the adult population, there are strict cutoffs by which we can determine whether or not somebody is obese or not based on their height and weight. But in pediatrics, because kids are growing, we have to look at this slightly differently. There are charts that allow us to take a look specific to the child's sex and age that allow us to determine whether or not the child is in fact in that category of overweight or obese. We have growth charts that also are helpful because we can plot the child's weight. And when we see that the child's weight goes above a certain number, then we know that that child is overweight and heading towards obesity. Another clue is to look how tall the child is. If the child is in the 10th percentile for height, but in the 90th percentile for weight, that's another clue that this child is overweight and heading towards obesity. So a couple of different ways of looking at this, and I think it's important to look at it in sort of a broad way because some children, for example, are more muscular or big-boned and other children are less so. So the ability to use just a number to interpret a child's weight and the risk for obesity has to be done carefully and respectful of what the child's physique or body composition looks like. How much muscle and how much bone are they?
So using these standard parameters, I mentioned that a fairly large percentage, 1 in 3 children now between 2 and 19 are overweight or obese. Does that sync with your understanding of where we are today?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, a great correlate of that is that 1 out of 3 children born today will develop diabetes. Mm. And if we think about that, it's staggering because upwards of perhaps 75 million people in the United States are at risk of developing diabetes. 25 million have it, and another 50 million are at risk. So we have a total population of about 75 million people who will go on to develop, or either have diabetes or will go on to develop diabetes, and this is in the adult community. And what we're currently seeing now in children being born today is that that's exactly where they're heading. And it is of great concern to us because in the absence of us being able to stop this, we are facing a situation where we will not be able to provide the appropriate services to the children and the young adults that need it. The truth is that the number of endocrinologists in this country are dwindling. The number of pediatric endocrinologists can't keep up with the volume of patients they need to see. And so this is a real real problem that we're seeing develop right before our very eyes.
Is there somewhat of a line in the sand that can be drawn to say before this approximate date, obesity in the United States and Western society was not an issue, and after this approximate date, it is an issue? Is it that clear cut, or is it somewhat like that? I'm just trying to get at and approach this issue of why is this a problem now?
Well, Tad, we have to take a step back and look how society has evolved. You know, at one time, we would walk from place to place. Now, people struggle to get a parking spot that's right up to the shopping center that they'd like to go to, and they'll circle around for 15 minutes, hoping that a spot close to the entrance will open up. If you think about that, that's a cultural change. It's saying, you know what, if I walk 50 feet, that's an inconvenience for me. We see simple errands being run using those kinds of means of transportation, so walking has disappeared. We no longer have to write. We can speak into devices that then send messages. We are constantly trying to improve our efficiency, constantly finding ways to expend less energy. We have elevators and escalators and walking and moving walkways, all of which did not exist. So as we see technology continuing to make our lives more efficient, because Lord knows we have so much more to do and so many more responsibilities that we've all taken on that we can't afford not to have those efficiencies, we begin to get a sense of how slowly but surely technology has encroached onto our ability to burn calories. And in fact, you know, one of the most effective techniques that I have with kids and their families is to ask them to think about how they can waste calories during the day. So as funny as this may sound, if a child is walking in a straight line to get from place A to place B, yeah, I tell them to take a detour and walk about 100 feet out of the way until you come back to the more direct route. So it gives you an opportunity to waste some calories. Get off the escalator. If there are two escalators, two steps in the escalator, get off at one and climb up the other. And I think that once we begin to make those kinds of cultural changes, going back to wasting energy and really burning calories unnecessarily, I think that's a great way of beginning to address it. You know, a colleague of mine said the other day, I'm on the treadmill. And I said, boy, what are you doing on the treadmill? And she said, I'm working. And I said, well, what do you mean? She says, well, I had a desk built right on top of my treadmill, and I'm working on my computer while it is that I'm walking on the treadmill. And I thought that was a brilliant innovation and thought about actually doing it for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, simple things like even having an upright desk, standing at a desk. People used to do that, and we rarely would see that today. Would burn more calories. We have a caller. Jerry, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you, Dan, just a comment that he seems to be running such an uphill battle on obesity in our society, and two examples I'll give, and I agree with his last comments, the entire culture is working against what he's trying to accomplish, and you know, the outcome is incredibly dangerous, but I unfortunately happened to spend some time in a hospital with a loved one for about a week, and the food served in the hospital was atrocious. In fact, patient refused to eat it. It was so bad. The other example, more of a cultural example, is where almost everything in our society, like he is saying, prohibits or at least contributes to people not becoming physically active or using any kind of physical means to do anything. So, you know, I think his goal is almost doomed unless we change almost every aspect of our society and quit becoming what we'd call efficient and time-saving and change every aspect. Culture can't change what he's trying to do. Almost every other aspect our society needs to change to do this.
And I think you're spot on in terms of your observation. You know, the Endocrine Society published a consensus paper, oh, back about 4 or 5 years ago, that I had been a part of, that said, you know what, in order to address this, it's not going to be simply increase your level of exercise. It's going to require urban planning. It's going to require legislation. It's going to require cooperation from the food industry. It's going to require cooperation from schools. It's going to require cooperation from parents. And when we see that and we sort of take a look at the big picture, this is a difficult battle to fight. And, you know, we are seeing some pieces of this come together slowly but surely. You'll see a city beginning to increase the number of bike lanes. You'll see school systems banning sugar-containing drinks. You'll see parent communities getting together and going to the schools and saying you've got to improve the menu choices. There are lots of different things happening, but not in a coordinated effort. And it's great to see those things at least being done. But I think that we need to have a more coordinated attempt, because at the end of the day, it's going to be a lot cheaper building bicycle lanes than it will be dealing with the complications of diabetes and all of the morbidities that come along with that condition, including gallbladder disease, liver disease, lung disease, heart disease, loss of limb and life, that could bankrupt the country. And I realize I'm being a bit hysterical here, but we shouldn't underestimate what that means when 35% of the population is at risk or develops diabetes.
Yeah, the only other example I'll use, again, I just came from the grocery store, and if you watch what people put in their baskets and go to the counter, it's appalling. I think we've lost the battle. I hate to be so pessimistic about it, and I'll hang up, but, you know, good luck in your efforts, but I think we've lost the war.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Let's, you know, I think Jerry also brings up the other half of this equation. At least in my mind, it's an equation. And as you've already alluded to, this is an energy issue. We've spent a lot of time talking about the fact that we are not expending as much energy as we used to, but we're also exposed to much more highly caloric dense foods and many more foods at a much less price than we would have been in the 50s and 60s as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, certainly the cost of fresh fruits and vegetables often are prohibitive relative to the calorie-dense foods that you mentioned, Dad. And I think it's important to note that, for example, if you go into a Starbucks and you realize that you have a drink that could be 700 or 800 calories. And, you know, it was eye-opening for me when I went into one of those coffee shops and actually saw the price, the caloric density of these drinks. It's incredible. So when people look at foods they buy, what they should be looking at is, what am I getting out of this food? Is it filling me? Am I getting good nutrition from it? Or is it just a bunch of junk in a pretty box which is selling? And I think that until we really develop a more discriminating way of approaching shopping, you know, it's going to be the best marketing package wins regardless of what's in it. You know, it's interesting. I was in the supermarket myself last week, and I decided to turn down the cereal aisle, and I checked every box of cereal. from the ones that you would think traditionally are considered to be more healthful to the ones that are considered to be more junk food. And what was fascinating to me is they all had the same calorie count. They all had the same nutritional content. Yet, you will look at one box and say, boy, that seems to be a lot healthier than that box, when in essence they're exactly the same.
Let me remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Henry Anholt, a pediatric endocrinologist. We're talking about childhood obesity. Questions and comments we can address between now and 3 o'clock local time by calling us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, or emailing us at line1@kska.org. Calories are the important issue, and you know, maybe that message is getting out there, but it is inevitable that the overweight families come in and say, my kids are not eating that much. I mean, you have to have heard that. How do you address that? How do you I talk about 3,500 calories per pound, and you've got to be in the negative 3,500 calories to lose a real pound, and vice versa. Do you approach it in a different way? Are you any more successful than the rest of us?
Well, there's no question, Dad, that if you look at the basic law of thermodynamics, it's energy in and energy out, and clearly, if you eat less and exercise more, you will burn calories, and there's no question about that. I think it can be frustrating for some people to see, you know, somebody goes to the local McDonald's and eats five cheeseburgers, and those individuals never gain a pound, whereas somebody walks by a bakery and gains 3 pounds. And so there's clearly something different about the person who goes to McDonald's and doesn't gain any weight and the person who walks by the bakery and does. I mean, in our society, we tend to lump everybody that's overweight into one category. You're overweight, you should eat less and exercise more.
Right.
But it's important to understand that that's not so straightforward. Mm-hmm. However, despite whatever differences and subcategories we can put individuals who are overweight into, at the end of the day, less calories in, more calories burned, results in weight loss.
So what I'm hearing you say is there are individual differences, it appears, that we're beginning to understand or trying to understand that may contribute to ease of gaining weight or ease of losing weight given the same diets. But all in all, it still gets down to lose weight, you got to burn off more than you're taking in and vice versa.
Absolutely. Even though it may seem inhumane for people who are having, you know, 900 or 1,000 calories a day. And, you know, there are some conditions. There's a genetic condition in children called Prader-Willi syndrome. And in Prader-Willi syndrome, their metabolism is so slow that they truly have to cut back to sometimes 700 or 800 calories a day. For example, the drink I refer to, having that drink alone as all of your intake for the day, it's pretty daunting of a task. And so either you believe that everyone who is overweight is lying and they're eating more than they should, which I don't believe, or that even those people who are eating a relatively small number of calories are a tremendous risk of gaining weight unless they really reduce their caloric intake and really increase their caloric expenditure.
All right. Dan, welcome to Line 1. What can we do for you?
Yeah, thanks. I have a comment and a question. I appreciate the earlier caller's sense of difficulty in changing behavior, but in our family, we've started doing something at the table that I think has made a big difference, at least it did for me, and I know it has for our kids. And this came out of Gary Taubes, is it? The Good Calorie, Bad Calorie book. We were reading that. I was reading that, and we just make a comment at the table whether or not something is food as opposed to a processed food substance or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll say something like, well, that's not really food, referring maybe to a slice of American cheese. And the kids just went, what? Well, it's this, that, or the other, as opposed to an apple or something like that.
Right.
And so that's really turned out to be pretty good now, because the kids will often ask at the table, well, is this food? And we'll say, well, sort of, or maybe not, but, you know, this is. Or when we go out to eat, especially someplace, they'll say, this isn't food, right? And go, no, it's not food. It's calories, but it's not food.
Yeah, it's like calorie-dense foods versus nutritionally dense foods.
It's another way of thinking. Yeah, it's the whole thing about like empty calories as well, with some of the, you know, with the drinks and that kind of stuff. But my my question is, if your guest has any sense of efforts moving at any local level or at the national level toward holding the food industry a little bit more accountable for the kind of crap they produce, if I can say that on the air, and sell, and turning it, you know, I guess one of the examples is the high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
That seems to be ubiquitous. You know, a hot dog bun can have as much sugar in it as a, for high fructose corn syrup, as a you know, a candy bar or something like that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Thanks
for your call. Dr. Unholt,
yes.
What's happening nationally, if you're aware of anything, that may be kind of asking food producers to change their ways?
Well, to address the caller's question, you know, the food industry is very smart and a very aggressive group of businesses. And so seeing the writing on the wall, they are beginning to change their message. They're beginning to provide research grants to aid scientists who are looking at pediatric and adult obesity to tease apart what it is that's causing this epidemic. And, you know, it's brilliant, because what it in essence does is it provides, you know, heading off at the pass. I'm going to preempt you, and I'm going to say, hey, I've been doing all I can. I'm supporting science and research. Or I'm going to take trans fats out of my food. And you're going to see packages that say trans fats, no trans fats. I'm going to take little blueberry muffins, and I'm going to put them in a 100-calorie pack. So you, as a parent giving this snack to your child, know you're only giving 100 calories of junk as opposed to 500 calories of junk. So I think that there is some change that's being driven by the industry itself to offset potential criticism. Now, on the flip side of that, I think that there is still an enormous amount of marketing dollars and attempts to really push these kinds of foods to kids. But, you know, the television ads that have been targeted towards kids for high-calorie, dense foods have been banned in many jurisdictions, not to be advertising during children's programming. It really creates a situation where the child says, hey, Mom, I was watching TV, and I really want to have that green calorie-laden juice. That's really what I want, because it's really cool, and it has a superhero attached to it. And so I think that that's a step forward and a demonstration of, you know, resistance against the food industry and changing the rules of the game. So there is movement. I think that, you know, in the city of New York, the Board of Education has banned sugar-containing beverages in the vending machines in the schools. And I think they've gotten with the food industry, who supported these moves. And again, that's a way of them saying, hey, you know, we're in this in the same place you are. It's like having a alcohol advertisement saying, drink responsibly. You know, we see how caring we are. You know, we'll feed you as much drink and as much alcohol as you'd like, but remember, drive responsibly.
We have to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners that if you have questions or comments, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our email address is lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails. and talk with Dr. Henry Anhalt on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our topic is pediatric obesity, and my guest is pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Peter Anhalt. Our phone messages or our calls can be accepted at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and email us at line1@kska.org. And please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and there won't be anybody here to take your calls at that time. Let's go ahead and take another phone call, Dr. Anhalt. Sarah, you're on line 1.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about adults who were obese as children and who are no longer obese, and if they have any sort of special health considerations, or if their risk status returns to that of somebody who is not obese.
So, yeah, you're asking about their risks if they were obese, and I'm interested in how come they're not obese anymore. So let's ask both those questions. Okay, Dr. Anhalt?
Well, I think that those are challenging questions to answer because, unfortunately, there aren't that many children who were obese that are no longer obese. The longer you stay obese as a child, the greater is the risk of you becoming an obese adult. On the other hand, the group that's most likely to have success with obesity management are adolescents. So if you think about it, you're in sort of a catch-22. On one hand, the longer you stay obese, the greater is the risk of becoming obese as an adult. On the other hand, you have to wait until you grow up in order to take effective measures towards reversing obesity. Undoubtedly, people who lose weight, kids or adults, if they're having high blood pressure, if they're having abnormalities in liver function, if they're having abnormalities in sleep, and this is one of the most underreported complications of obesity, and that's sleep apnea. So you will see reversal of these complications. The exact calculation of risk, per se, I don't think has been done. I think that in order to really accomplish that, you need a large study with large numbers of patients, and I don't think that data is available currently.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Sarah. Along the same line, a question I wanted to ask later, is it better for someone who is overweight to maintain their current weight? What's the risks and benefits of maintaining versus going ahead and trying to lose weight? There seems at times we hear information that may or may not be adequate or accurate that losing weight has some risk associated. So I want to put that question on the table as well.
So in children, it's particularly important to recognize that as they grow, they will indeed gain weight. And it is very common for pediatricians and pediatric endocrinologists to use the following phrase, let the child grow into it. In other words, have the child not lose any weight, but rather have them grow linearly in height to become more appropriate for the weight, or have their weight become more appropriate for the height. So it's not so much that we're looking in the growing child to lose weight, but rather to keep the weight stable and to grow to allow your height, your weight relative to your height to improve.
Okay. And that would be safe. What about an adult who is now 25 or 30 years of age who wants to lose weight? What's the risks and benefits of maintaining versus losing weight? Is it clear that it's better to lose weight than it is to maintain being overweight?
So the question really is about fat and fit versus skinny and not fit. And I don't know if this is going to directly answer your question, but certainly in an individual who is fit but overweight and not losing weight, and they become more fit with time, that's going to be preferable to somebody who loses weight and isn't necessarily fit. So, I don't know if that answers the question specifically enough. Yeah.
I don't want to, and maybe we don't have the answer. I want to make sure we're communicating well. It seems to me I have heard in the past that, let's say someone is significantly overweight as an adult, that there might be significant risk with losing weight versus just maintaining that weight and not getting more overweight, more obese. And that was used as an excuse for not losing weight. Does that make sense from a risk-benefit standpoint?
It doesn't, Tad. It doesn't.
Okay.
I mean, when you look at, for example, individuals who've undergone gastric bypass,
mm-hmm.
Where they lose a tremendous amount of weight, these individuals are at great risk for a number of complications, including kidney stones, vitamin deficiencies, but that's because they've had an alteration in their intestinal architecture. However, in a person who loses weight and does it intelligently with the appropriate amount of exercise, that's exactly what we want to happen.
Okay. All right, let's take some more phone calls. We got about three people holding here. Mary, you're on line one.
Yes, thank you. I would like to make one quick comment, and then I have a question for your guest. I grew up in Scotland in the 50s and 60s, and it's true what your guest says about school photographs. When I look back, the people then look quite different to the children in school photographs now. They look as if they're undernourished, but of course they're not. They were perfectly normal.
And they actually look skinny, don't they?
Yes, they do. It's funny. But we were all perfectly healthy.
Right.
I do remember we never got things like ice cream or soda unless it was at a birthday party or if it was Christmas. You had no junk food at all. There wasn't so much around, and also it was very expensive. So you definitely ate much, much better, I would say. And so that's the comment I have to make. And also, children were out playing, running and jumping and skipping, rather than following the solitary pursuits that they do now on Game Boys and videos. And I walked 3 miles to school, a three-mile round trip to school. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I would like I have a question for your guest, please, and that is, I hear a lot of people today saying that they can't or their children can't lose weight because that's just how they are and because they're big boned or they've tried to lose weight and they just get to a certain stage and they can't. And I don't buy that. I think that if they tried harder, they could lose weight. However, my question is there really a group of people who will become obese and who will, for various reasons, perhaps metabolic, never manage to lose weight and perhaps end up needing a gastric bypass operation or medication? And I'll take my response off
the air.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
So there was a multi-part question, and I guess the first part that I'd like to address is the issue around children being more sedentary. And the average American child spends about 4 to 5 hours a day in front of the television. Now, when I was growing up, we would go outside, we would ride bicycles, we would play sports, but nobody sat inside playing video games or watching TV for 4 to 5 hours. I do want to raise one caution, and that is that, you know, the rewarding or the creating a scenario where, you know, soft drinks and cake are offered as a special thing around birthdays, I find that sometimes to be a little bit problematic because the essence of the message really to the child is, here is this special stuff that we save for special occasions. And I think that potentially sends a message that may not be the best in today's society since it's not coupled with a lot of physical activity. And lastly, is there a group of people who cannot lose weight? Is it true that the parents say, we can't, we've tried? I mean, I saw two patients today who made the same claims. And it really comes down to, do I believe that they simply are lying and are not doing what they could do to maximize weight loss? Or are they different metabolically? And I do believe that people are different metabolically. That's not to say they can't lose weight, but certainly it would be more challenging. Now, it's interesting because certain individuals who are overweight seem to have no complications at all from their overweight. Their cholesterol is normal, their blood pressure is normal, and they really don't seem to have any major problems. There's no premature death, there's no coronary artery disease, where that may not be true in another group, perhaps less afflicted by overweight. So I think it's a complex issue that's not entirely clear about how we partition calories, how we use them, and what risk overweight puts each of us at, depending on our genetic predisposition.
Now, there are a number of issues, as you said, that don't seem to necessarily correlate in all individuals. But we also haven't mentioned things that are more psychosocial. There's more depression, more anxiety in individuals that are overweight. And that, again, to say that not everybody who's overweight has those problems. And even orthopedic issues, particularly in some kids that are overweight. So there's a huge number of issues that have been associated with them. But again, your point is well taken. Not everyone gets any or all of these.
Yeah, and I think very much to your point, I think it's important to evaluate children for these things. And I think one of the easiest tip-offs is to check some laboratory testing. And I think a family history combined with judicious use of laboratory testing tell a very powerful story. And the question is, you know, how many factors do you need in order to assess risk? And there have been some studies that have looked at that. You know, if you have a family history and you have an abnormal cholesterol, you're at greater risk. If you have a family history and you have abnormal blood pressure, you're at greater risk, and you're X-fold at risk, depending on how many factors you in fact have. They have to be custom-made, but I think the investigations need to take place in order to completely characterize patients. And if you talk to people who are overweight, it's very common for there to be snoring and sleep apnea. And my recommendation is, in situations like that, that people get sleep studies to really elucidate, you know, what kind of difficulty they're having with as a result of their overweight with breathing at night.
John, if you're really calling from Dead Horse, I would be remiss not to take your question. What can we do for you?
Yes, I'm really calling from Dead Horse, and the weather is really atrocious today.
Well, anyway, welcome to Anchorage.
My question is this. If we treat excessive calories on both sides of the question, whether it's from the manufacturers or the consumers, we treat it like cigarettes and we tax it, will this help curb the obesity problem in this country? And I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, good question. Do we know whether tax policy may have some impact on our problem, and is it being considered as another issue?
Well, you know, I think that if we use tobacco as an example, I think it's quite clear that raising the prices of cigarettes definitely made a difference. Gasoline, raising the price of gasoline seems to decrease the utilization of gas. Now, it may be different when it comes to food, but I have no reason to believe that it would be. So I think it's fair to say that that may, in fact, be effective. Now, it's interesting, and I'm not exactly sure in what state of the union this is, but there are a number of programs, health programs, and benefits programs that are in fact taxing individuals who are overweight for their health care benefits. So, for example, if you're morbidly overweight, your premium for your health care may be higher than if you're not. And I think that's another way of looking at tax, saying, you know what, we won't insure you, or we'll insure you for less, or we'll ask you to pay more if, in fact, you're obese and you refuse to enter an obesity treatment program, or you refuse to attempt to lose weight.
Similarly, our health care insurance mechanisms in this country right now are not at all helpful in trying to address it. It's usually an out-of-pocket situation, is my understanding.
You know, unfortunately, well, let's say this, that the treatments currently for diabetes or obesity prevention are not all that successful. And if you look at those programs that are completely replete with resources, they have some modicum of success, but it's limited. So, you know, the recidivism is very, very high, and the long-term successes are very, very low. So the third-party payers, the insurance companies say, hey, why should we pay for this unproven therapy that may actually not be all that effective? There is increasing reimbursement for things like gastric bypass because that, quote-unquote, fixes the problem. Mm-hmm. It doesn't prevent it, but it fixes the problem. I think that this is a real issue, but I think it's also incumbent upon those who have obesity treatment programs to actually collect enough data to convince the third-party payers that it's worth paying for.
Very good point. Very good point. Let's take another caller. Kevin, you're on line one.
Thank you for taking the call. The question was for the doctor. We've been talking about different ideas of liability, whether it be from food companies or other places, or but I wanted to just kind of pose the question of, you know, individual adults can make intelligent decisions about their own health for themselves, whereas a child is kind of reduced to the decisions and the actions and behavior of their parents. Is there any potential for liability, parents being held liability for not cultivating a healthy child? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
All right.
Very challenging question. So if I take my child to eat at McDonald's, am I causing child abuse? And the question really is very, very difficult to answer because it becomes a very, very slippery slope. Very slippery slope. So, again, you know, where do you draw the line? If I let my child stay up late and they're tired and they're less productive, am I putting my child's health at risk? And on and on and on. If they have a hot dog, why is it we would stop it at weight per se rather than looking at a more global picture of what parents provide for kids? I think it's just a slippery slope, and we have to be really careful about putting blame on parents for these kinds of situations. And I'll give you a small example. There was a young lady who I was asked to treat from down south, who was clearly a victim of a genetic disease that I could not name and could not decipher. I could not tease out. And this kid was, I don't know, she was 4 and she was close to 300 pounds. I mean, she was grotesquely obese. She could not bend to tie her shoelace. I mean, we're talking grotesquely obese. They arrested the mother because they felt for sure she was overfeeding and forcing her to gain weight. Please keep in mind, you could take the fattest kid and force feed them. They're going to throw up. There's no way they're going to get to be that weight. This kid has a genetic abnormality, and despite the fact that we couldn't tease it apart, she's got it. There was absolutely no reason and completely inappropriate to put this mother in jail.
Yeah. All right. We got one more caller. We're getting close to about 7 or 8 minutes before the end of the program. Janine, you're on line one.
Hi. I wanted to know, ask the doctor, what's your research telling you currently about sugar and carbohydrate levels and how, you know, their cascading effects influence insulin and weight gain?
You're talking about levels in the bloodstream or levels in food?
Levels in food.
Okay.
I'm not sure I get your question.
Okay.
Can you rephrase it?
Sure. I've currently been restricting my sugar and carbohydrate intakes, and I'm finding really impressive results with it.
Okay.
And I've been overweight off and on most of my life, and I have asthma as a child and still do, and have had a lot of problems breathing. With
yeah,
breathing
so it's a low-fat, low-carbohydrate diet,
no.
Which is one of the...
No, low-fat.
No, I'm asking...
Sugar.
Yeah, no, I was asking whether one is better than the other is kind of what you're getting at.
No, actually, I'm wanting to know if you are at all involved in any of the new research on how the combination of sugar, how that creates this cascading effect. If so much of it, then it dumps extra insulin into the system, and it keeps you with belly fat.
Yeah, so there's no question, obviously, that the more simple sugar you have, the greater is the insulin production. And so that's quite clear. How the fat gets distributed around the belly or elsewhere is to some degree related to the insulin levels, and you know, when you distribute fat around the waist, it is far worse for you than distributing it around the thighs. If you think about the apple versus the pear, the apple is much worse than the pear. And why is it that some people will deposit around the apple versus around the pear is unclear. I don't know for sure. I'm not familiar with any research that says if you eat sugar, you're more likely to put the weight around your abdomen, around your belly.
Okay.
Thanks for your question.
Thank you.
In the last couple of minutes, another question that I would like you to comment on, is there any relationship between breastfeeding and formula feeding in infancy and the later onset of obesity?
So the answer to that question, Ted, which is a good one, will always be, regardless of what the question is, that it's better to breastfeed than it is to bottle feed. And so it doesn't matter if you say, will it give you a longer life? Will it improve your immune system? Always breastfeeding is the Rolls Royce of food that you can give to a child. There is some data to suggest that breastfed babies have a lower incidence of obesity, but let's take a step back from that for a moment and think about whether or not a child being breastfed is being raised in a home that has less risk factors for obesity versus one that's being fed a bottle. Now, that's not to say that every baby that's fed a bottle is going to ultimately end up obese or is not being raised in a home that's conscious about those kinds of things. But it's more likely in a breastfed home, at least in the United States, to consider that that child is being raised in a quote-unquote more wholesome environment.
Mm-hmm. It's the coincidence causality argument, and you know, is you're saying, as I hear you saying, is a bottle fed or formula fed more of a marker for other risk factors for obesity as well?
Yeah.
All right. So, why is weight loss so difficult to achieve, and why is it, if you achieve it, so difficult to maintain?
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the first callers said that it's a upstream or uphill fight. And again, there are so many forces of nature pushing us to gain weight. And it's a biological advantage. We have to remember, you know what? If food was scarce, we would be far better off having obesity than we would being thin. So the thinner you are, the greater risk you have of dying. So of course it makes sense that we would, in those who are genetically predisposed, that you would in fact push yourself to become obese, or your body would push itself to become obese in those individuals who have the risk to do so. And so the body sees weight loss as a threat. And if we recognize that, we can begin to sort of get past the guilt and the shame and really begin to look at this from a perspective of, hey, this is a biological advantage that's gone awry in a society of plenty. We need to do something here. And we need to work with what we have as a risk.
Let me sum up the show again in a way I like to do it. Let me ask you about your final thoughts and suggestions in the last minute or so. And what do we want to take away? What do we want to make sure people understand and remember?
I think it's important to remember a couple of things, Thad, and that is, number one, it's oftentimes not the person's fault that they're overweight, but rather a confluence of genetic risk, of environmental factors, and social arrangements and urban planning. Two, that being overweight is bad for you, and that we're looking at a burgeoning epidemic of type 2 diabetes, and we need to push our legislators and our representatives to do something about it from a legislative and governmental perspective. And lastly, that if you change your lifestyle and you can stick with it, you're likely to have success, but it is an ongoing battle and something you have to work on day by day.
Okay. Well, we very much appreciate your taking the time out of your early evening to be with us, and have a great great evening.
Thank you. You too. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Let me just mention also, if those of you who are listening, if you want to get more reliable information on issues relating to obesity and things you might do, there's two web links on our KSKA.org Line 1 website. Also, tomorrow we're going to continue this discussion about obesity. I will be a guest on Talk of Alaska with Steve Heimel at 10 a.m., and we'll be looking at some local efforts and discussing more about our efforts to eliminate juvenile obesity in Alaska and throughout the nation. Finally, I want to also mention that within the next program, I feel very lucky to be able to interview Timothy Ferris. Timothy is the producer of the information that went up on the Voyager spacecraft, and he has taught history and journalism and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and has recently produced and written a book called The Science of Liberty. The subtitle is Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. He's been called the best popular science writer in the English language, and he's a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. And we will be discussing the role of science in the formation of our country and how our country's founding principles, such as freedom and equality, may actually be undermining our attempts at health care reform. I encourage people to take the time to listen to our program next week. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.